I didn't get an hour of sleep last night.
Welcome. We are opening the meeting of the House Economic Development and Trade Committee for March 13th, 2017. Today we have two informational hearings. We have two bills on the calendar for work sessions, but it turns out that both of those need to be held over for a little additional refinement before they're ready for us to work. And so we will move forward with two good work sessions. First, I want to note that I believe there is a letter. I'm sorry, informational hearings. I believe that we have a letter that Mr. Crawford is circulating to committee members regarding investment in the Oregon State University Fermentation Center and Food Innovation Center, apropos of work that we've done in a prior informational hearing and conversations. Would you like to touch on that briefly, and maybe we can circulate it while we're here today?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, last Friday I dropped off a letter on behalf of the Oregon State Fermentation Program, as well as the Quality Food and Beverage Initiative, to each one of your offices. The hope was that over the weekend and early this week, you might have a chance to review it, potentially show your interest about signing on to it. On Wednesday, I'll bring a hard copy of the letter, hopefully for everyone to sign if they're interested. If you are not interested in signing, please don't hesitate to let me know, and I can remove your name from the letter.
Excellent. Okay. And with that, we'll open an informational meeting on the Main Street Revitalization Grant Program and invite forward Sherry Stewart, who is the coordinator of the program for Oregon Department of Parks and Recreation, to give us an update on how that's going and what you're looking to in the future.
Thank you. Chair Leininger and members of the Committee on Economic Development and Trade. For the record, I am Sherry Stewart, coordinator of the Oregon Main Street Program, which is part of Heritage Programs in Oregon Parks and Rec. Thank you for having me at the meeting today. Oregon Main Street is our statewide downtown revitalization program. We use the Main Street approach, which is a registered trademark of the National Main Street Center. Dollar for dollar, Main Street has been proven to be one of the most impactful and cost-effective community revitalization models in the country. It's been used in over 2,000 communities across the country. We hold the registered trademark brand with the National Main Street Center to enable the communities in Oregon to use this model. I have just a couple of slides about our program, and then I'll talk specifically about the Oregon Main Street Revitalization Grant. In Oregon, we were restarted in 2007 and took on our first communities beginning in 2008. We now serve over 80 communities across Oregon, both in all corners of the state. So down in Lakeview, up to Enterprise, down to Brookings and Astoria, and all points in between. So we really have a broad reach. Essentially, we provide technical assistance to communities to help them start their own grassroots downtown revitalization programs. The vast majority of programs across the state are 100% volunteer. So the economic development efforts that they're able to achieve, that's based on preserving the historic character of their communities, is really an astonishing feat. One of the new tools that we've been given, in addition to the technical assistance, is the Main Street Revitalization Grant Program. Here's a listing of our communities. So in Oregon, while we have to follow the National Main Street Stop model, each state is able to develop their own system in terms of how we deliver technical assistance to our communities using that model. In Oregon, when we were restarted, we developed a tier system to help communities wherever they were at with their revitalization efforts. So our performing Main Street level communities, we have nine communities or districts that are participating at that level. Those are communities that are nationally recognized by the National Main Street Center and are full-blown Main Street communities. But we want to help communities wherever they're at. So in our tier system, our top three levels are our Main Street track. Those are communities that working at or implementing the Main Street model. We also have communities that are interested in downtown revitalization but aren't yet ready or not wanting to use the Main Street model yet, and those are our affiliate level communities. So overall, we have 80 that we're working with. Beginning in 2010, I started with the program in 2009 here in Oregon. Beginning in 2010, from our top level communities, we began tracking data. And then in 2011, from our second tier, our Transforming Downtown, we began tracking data from them. Since that time, we've had in our Main Street districts, in those top two tier levels, over 385 net new businesses opening. This doesn't include business expansions or businesses that have chosen to move into the district from other parts of the community or from other communities. It's purely net new businesses that have opened in our districts. So while we have had some business closures, we've had significant numbers of net new businesses that have opened in our communities. We've created over 2,600 net new jobs in our Main Street districts, represented from those new businesses that have opened. We've seen over 1,000 building rehab projects that have taken place. Those are small scale, by and large, everything from paint, signage, new awnings, those types of things, to full building rehab projects. We've had over $75 million in private reinvestment in districts in those building rehab projects, and over $91 million in net public reinvestment in those districts. That's everything from streetscape improvements to public art, things that are permanent public features of our downtown districts. So we are having an economic impact in our district. When Oregon Main Street started, we were still in the economic downturn, but year over year in our Main Street districts, we've had net job, net business openings, net private and public sector reinvestment in our communities. In 2015, the legislature passed the Oregon Main Street Revitalization Grant Program. This gave us a whole new tool this year to begin helping our communities with some of those major building rehab projects that they want to see happen in their communities. It's been the but for. We would like to have this building rehabbed or these upper floors being put back to use, but for the money that's available for them. We're right now have an application open. It closes this Friday. The Main Street Revitalization Grant is funded through the sale of a lottery bond, which is scheduled to take place either this month or next month. And so it's a one-time only infusion of funding. The pool of the grant program itself is a permanent fund, but there was only the one-time sale of the lottery bond to fund that. The Main Street grant is open to any of the tiers, so communities participating at any level in the Oregon Main Street Revitalization Grant Program is eligible to apply for this particular grant. On this particular slide, the lower two photos are of two potential projects that are seeking funding from the grant program that we've talked to the communities. One is from Klamath Falls. Klamath Falls has been doing an excellent job the past couple of years in doing a series of upper floor workshops to encourage property owners to develop some of those vacant spaces. They have a couple of projects that have highlighted to create upper floor housing. This particular project is to create 20 upper floor living spaces. In the lower right-hand corner in Independence, this is a project that has been on the books for a couple of years in that community. The owner has had approved plans and engineering studies for this to turn it into a brewery, but hasn't had the funding to be able to go forward. So this particular project is a priority for that community. The purpose of the Oregon Main Street Revitalization Grant is really for building improvement projects that spur economic development. So that's to retain a business within a Main Street district, to allow a business to expand, or to create a space to attract a new business. So, and it can go towards the acquisition, rehabilitation, or construction of new infill buildings appropriate to the character of the district in which it's going. Grants are up to $100,000 with a 70-30 split. Up to that max, 70% of the costs can be covered by the grant, 30% can be cash in kind or volunteer time counted against the match. This particular project shown on here is the project that Beaverton is interested in submitting for the grant. It's to create a shell-ready space for a restaurant. Currently, it's not being used. So the types of projects that can be funded, we really kept it broad and open. So it can be the rehabilitation or restoration of properties, facade improvements, if there's upper floors that have been vacant or underutilized, to put those back into productive use. It could be creating upper floor housing so that you have customers then that can be 24-hour eyes on the street in our Main Street districts, structural repairs, code compliance, first floor interior. It's really pretty broad. It could also be, as I mentioned, compatible new infill construction, and we have some folks that are interested in that. The missing teeth in a downtown, if you have those buildings that have been lost in a downtown, that's considered the missing teeth. It's really a pedestrian stopper for the neighboring businesses. It can also be used for the rehabilitation of multiple properties. So if a district has a whole block that needs facade improvements, or perhaps a whole block that needs a elevator to be able to provide access to upper floors, the grant can be used for that purpose as well, or fire sprinklers to get some of those. Not sure why that's moving forward. So a wide variety of uses for that. This particular project that's shown on this slide is in Astoria. It's a building that has been sitting vacant for 30 years. There's a high need in Astoria for workforce housing. The cost of housing for the workers in the district and for others in the community is very high. So this particular project, if they move forward with submitting it, would create 40 workforce housing units within the district. In terms of grant priorities for the Main Street grant, our Main Street track communities are performing, transforming, and exploring downtown level communities do have priority over the affiliate, all things being equal. However, all levels are eligible to apply. Projects within Main Street communities that also happen to be participants in our certified local government or have a National Register Historic District also receive priority. Main Street is a practical approach to downtown revitalization, but it's economic development based upon historic preservation. So some of those goals are important to us as well. It's for areas that demonstrate the greatest need for revitalization and economic development, or projects that the community has within their well-prioritized work plans. We work with communities quite a lot to establish their goals and objectives for their downtown revitalization. So the closer that they can link their revitalization project to their revitalization goals, that would be all things being equal, a higher priority for us. Projects that are located in traditionally underserved communities and projects that just demonstrate a readiness to move forward. The Main Street Revitalization Grant, once they're awarded the funds, they do have 3 years to complete the project because some of these will be significant renovation projects for their communities. We've provided a great deal of services to communities that are participating in our network ever since the approval of the grant program. We spent all last year not only doing the rules-making process, but also helping communities get ready to apply, doing strategic planning sessions with them, doing webinars and trainings on planning, providing checklists to help them determine which projects meet their needs and are ready to go. We did a two-day building development workshop in Astoria in partnership with the Clatsop Community College Preservation Trade Program so that people understood the development process and how to work with the developers in their communities. We provided some design assistance to show what the before and afters. This is an example from Newburgh of the Chapters Bookstore of design assistance that we were able to provide, as well as a grant workshop to show people how to actually complete the grant application. As of last week, and again, the deadline's coming up this week, so we know we still have a lot in the pipeline, so this isn't capturing all by any means, but we do know that right now we have 27 open applications in our online system from 23 different communities. 14 are rural, 13 are not. The way the bill was written, at least 50% of the funds must go to rural communities in Oregon. Some of the types of projects, there's theater rehab, restaurants, facade improvements, lodging upper floor, lodging and retail, second floor housing, housing and retail, just general rehab, one acquisition project that will lead to a new infill, and other retail improvement type projects. We're very appreciative. We also know that there's a lot of communities that were interested in applying for the grant, but just weren't ready. But unfortunately, this is a one-time infusion of funds. Some of those projects will be trying to work with them in other ways to figure out how they might fund some of those projects. But we're extremely grateful for this new tool that we're working with communities to be able to do some of these major rehab projects. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much. Do we have any questions about the program? Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How many of the cities that are using the Main Street program also have urban renewal, do you know?
Okay, sure. Thank you. I would say a majority of our performing Main Street level communities do also have urban renewal districts, and those have been a funding tool for those communities. For example, Albany has a very strong urban renewal program, and that has benefited their district quite significantly. So that is a tool, but not all of our communities. And I would say some of the ones that are further down in the tier system, many of those probably don't have that yet in place. But, yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Marshall and Representative Reschke.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair. Could you just say a little bit more about what's required to be part of the network at the different levels, what a community has to do?
Sure. To participate in the network, the top two tiers, the Performing Main Street and the Transforming Downtown level, those are communities that are really dedicated to using this National Main Street model to downtown revitalization. They have to complete a fairly extensive application and then show a strong readiness to implement. At the Performing Main Street level, that means that they must have a paid staff person, they must have a board of directors and nonprofit organization in place. They must have Main Street is a four-point approach. It's looking at the organizational structure, the physical features of the downtown, promotion and marketing, as well as the economic development side of things. So having a committee structure in place that's working on all four elements. Transforming Downtown must meet all of those requirements, with the exception that they don't have to have a paid staff person. They can have a volunteer. Many of those communities also tap into the Rare AmeriCorps program out of the University of Oregon to provide staff support, and that has been a tremendous resource to these communities. And some, like Dayton, they've had Kelly Haverkate, who has been their volunteer Main Street coordinator for 7 years and has been doing a really tremendous job. And tiny Dayton, it only has 2,500. They have completely transformed their their downtown in the past few years. So you have to demonstrate a high capacity. At the Exploring Downtown and the affiliate level, it's a very simple one-page application to participate at those two levels. At the Exploring Downtown, it means that they'll work with us to help get their nonprofit organization in place, and they'll begin to get a committee structure in place. They don't really aren't really required to do that point. At the affiliate level, that means they're just interested. They're not ready to move forward, so there's really no participation requirement. They have to attend one of our trainings every couple of years and submit a very brief report to us to just say if they've had any movement forward with their revitalization effort. So it depends on what level intensity that they're required to participate. But we're trying... In my world, I've been doing Main Street downtown revitalization for 27 years. I started as a Main Street coordinator in a small town in Washington. And so in my world, downtown revitalization is a continuum with Main Street at the pinnacle. But if we can just help communities move up that continuum, then we feel like they're being better off. And that's what we feel that our system, our tier system, really provides that ability for communities to participate at whatever level that they're able. In my opinion, every community should be at least in a affiliate.
Mm-hmm. Representative Reschke.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your presentation this morning. My question has to do with the one-time infusion of funds that you said. What's the amount for this bond? And when you say one-time infusion, are you saying for the next 2 years or for the next 10 years, or how's that work?
It's a $2.5 million lottery bond.
Okay.
It was for this year, and if we have applications that we can give out the whole amount, then we will grant the whole amount this year.
Okay. So then next year there'll be another? No, just this year. Okay.
Correct.
Thank you.
Do you have a follow-up?
It's a little different. It's you talked about 50% go to urban and 50% to rural. Is that correct, how the grants are distributed, or did I misunderstand that?
That's correct. That was according to the bill.
Okay.
So according to the bill, at least 50% must go to rural communities.
And do you have a definition of what that is? Is it 40,000? Is it 20,000 residents? Or do we know what? Is that a standard definition in the Oregon legislature?
It was in the bill, and I'm sorry that I can't recall it. It was outside of urban areas of 30,000, I think, within a specified district. But I apologize. I don't remember the specific language. I can get that to
Okay.
you.
Thank you.
So I have a question. I recall from when I was at Clackamas County that this program is housed, and you noted, of course, at the beginning that it's housed at the Parks Department. Why is it not in Business Oregon?
When Oregon Main Street was first restarted in the state in 2007, it was housed in Business Oregon. But at the time that I started in 2009, we were jointly administered with Oregon Parks and Rec and Heritage Programs. And actually, that's where I have physically lived. And there was only a one-time funding through the legislature for the program when it was in Business Oregon. Mm-hmm. Heritage Programs actually had some funds to fund the program by the time that I started. Business Oregon moved in the traded sector, and while they supported the concept of Main Street, we no longer met the agency's mission. Parks and Rec was willing to take our program on full time. Across the country, Main Street programs are housed. There's a percentage, I would say probably about 40% are housed, if not more, in state government. Some are housed in Commerce, or the state's equivalent of Commerce, or our equivalent of Business Oregon. A few are housed in Parks and Rec or their heritage programs, the State Historic Preservation Office. Main Street is that balance of economic development and historic preservation. Main Street really is, to me, it's kind of strengthening the heart of a community, and if the heart is strong, the rest of the community is strong, and it's asset-based economic development. So recognizing that historic character, those history, those old buildings actually do have an economic future is really what this program, so it kind of straddles both.
I have a couple follow-up questions. I don't know if anyone else has questions, flag me, and I'm happy to call on you. How many FTE are involved with implementation of the Main Street program, and what's the overall annual budget of the Main Street program?
Well, we're not really a program, so we're part of Heritage Programs, so we actually don't have a budget. I have been the full-time FTE. Last year, Katie was hired, and she has other duties, but now part-time she assists me with Main Street.
Okay. So. And then I'm trying to figure out the suite of resources that are available to support, to kind of subsidize invigoration of downtowns, and it seems like there are kind of a bunch of funding streams, and I'm trying to understand how they fit together. There's urban renewal, possibility of local improvement districts. Chambers of Commerce have as their mission invigorating downtown businesses, right?
Sometimes.
And then this program calls for a nonprofit, the creation of a nonprofit infrastructure also, and then gives just grants to private businesses to upgrade their buildings in the hopes that those buildings will then be more attractive to consumers. Is there any restriction on what a private business owner can do after they get a $100,000 grant, you know, to make their building nicer?
Oh, there definitely has to be a development plan, and it has to be linked to goals and objectives. And yes, there are a lot of tools, but
And then Small Business Development Center loans.
Sure.
Right?
Sure. Yeah, for Main Street districts, those tend to not be as useful. With downtown revitalization, when you look at the state of downtowns across our state and across the country, there's been a spiral of disinvestment in the communities, and that's why the Main Street approach was initially developed and why it has worked in a number of communities across the country. Because there, even despite there being a lot of other entities in place, like Chambers of Commerce, they have a broader focus than just downtown revitalization. And so this approach was developed sort of like a shopping center needs to have a mall manager in place that's 100% focused on that business line. Downtowns need that mall manager in place, that downtown manager in place, and that's what a Main Street program does. It fulfills that function on behalf in terms of, it's a little bit more challenging because you're working with independent business owners and property owners, so it's sort of like herding cats a little bit.
So the city council function doesn't meet that need, or the mayor or the city manager?
No. They have other focuses rather than that 100% focus. And I guess I can speak to this directly, not only seeing the impact when a Main Street community comes in town, but from my own personal experience, because I was that executive director of a Main Street program when I started my career in a small town in the state of Washington, and just saw what that program firsthand did. And we worked in partnership with the Chamber of Commerce and our countywide economic development. We worked very closely as the private sector partner to local government, but local government can't really drive the revitalization effort. It really needs the business and property owners to be involved, and that's what a Main Street program really does. When you look at one of our communities, so Dayton, that's very close to here. When they first started, they had a number of vacancies in their downtown, and the buildings were tired, and nothing was happening really on that side until the Main Street program came into being. Since that time, they've had their first new infill building in 50 years. They've had 8 building rehab projects. They've had new businesses relocate. And so that That's what a MEES-3 program can do. It steps in and it's that partner. It provides that laser-like focus that a downtown needs for revitalization efforts. Despite those other really good organizations that are in a community, many towns really need that group that steps in to be that partnership building across the board to get all of the different entities and organizations rolling up their sleeves and working together.
Thank you so much. Any other questions for our speaker? Okay, great. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
All right, we're closing the informational hearing on Main Street Revitalization and opening an informational hearing on cross-laminated timber in Oregon. And we are going to call forward, please, Anule Halova, Jonathan Trutt, Thomas Robinson, and Valerie Johnson, whom we understand would like to all be at the front at the same time. So, but if you change your mind, feel free to come up in waves. And Len Bernstein also. So,
but I'll be leaving. So
but he'll be leaving. All right.
Substantive part of the discussion.
All right.
Go forward.
All right. So, yeah, why don't a couple of you come forward, and then as Len steps back, you could kind of replace him. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Leininger and members of the committee. My name is Len Bergstein, and I'm delighted to introduce this panel on the discussion, as the chair said, on cross-laminated timber and a project known as Framework. Just this weekend, NPR did a wonderful story on this project and how rural and urban Oregon are working together to benefit all Oregonians in this project. When we first brought this project forward to the chair and the vice chairs, you were quick to see the opportunity in this for a discussion that would be fruitful and also lead to hopefully some good things as this project moves forward in the policymaking process. So I'm going to turn it over to Anule and the team, and I'll be back here to answer any questions also. Thanks very much.
Okay, great.
A lot of moving parts. Hello.
Hi. Please begin by stating your name for the record, and we look forward to hearing your presentation.
Thank you. My name is Anule Halova, and I'm a partner with a company called Project. We are a commercial real estate development firm out of Portland. We've done work in Eugene and Corvallis and also in Bend. And I'm here to talk about the Framework project, as Len mentioned. After me, Jonathan Trutt from Home Forward will be speaking about the affordable housing components of the project. And Thomas Robinson will be detailing more about the technology involved and why this is an innovative project and one of its kind in the United States. And then we'll be hearing from Valerie Johnson, who will be talking about the significance of such a project to her business and also to the state of Oregon. So with that, I wanted to talk about the project. So the project is located in, will be located in the Pearl District on 10th and Gleason. Right next to major transportation. The streetcar line runs right there. And so it's a very highly amenitized neighborhood, obviously very visible for a project like this. And a lot of people ask us, you know, where did this project come from, the idea behind it, such an innovative project. The project is trying to be the first building in the United States that's a high rise, so essentially a skyscraper made out of wood. Currently, this is not allowed by any building code in the United States, and so very innovative in that regard. Well, early on, our company, as a developer, was talking to Beneficial State Bank, and Beneficial State Bank is a community bank that's also owned by a parent company that owns Albina Community Bank, and a lot of people know Albina Community Bank because its role in the community. Both banks are very mission-driven, and the profits that come from Beneficial State Bank actually go back into the communities that they serve. And so they're very much into helping small businesses, into economic development, thinking about minority businesses, thinking about women-owned businesses, environmental businesses, and that's their focus. And so we were talking to them about how could we do a project that realized their values as a bank, making a tremendous impact in the community. And their values are economic development, economic opportunity, social equity, and environmental responsibility. So when we were thinking about this, we said, you know, when it comes to environmental responsibility, Portland has been kind of on the forefront of that for a while, Oregon as a state. And really, you know, what is the next wave in, or what is the next thought process in environmental responsibility? A lot of the things dealing with the environment have to do with things that you add to a building rather than the inherent qualities of the building themselves. So we started to say, you know, what about the actual materials of a building could respond to the environment? And then thinking about economic opportunity, a lot of times you think about just who makes the building and the process of making the actual building rather than where are those materials coming from in the first place and who are those materials benefiting by acquiring them. And so as we were thinking about this, you know, the idea of cross-laminated timber had just started to come out as a kind of a topic in the industry, and thinking about, wow, that would really start to address true environmental responsibility and really talk about economic opportunity that wasn't just for the urban centers where these projects happen, but actually connect our rural communities and our urban communities with our expertise in both to create economic opportunity for all. And so, you know, we thought, should we do that? That sounds great. Got into the details of that, realized it's not really allowed, realized it would be super risky for a real estate developer to take on that concept, you know, and the risk involved in that. So right around that time, we had heard about a competition that the USDA, along with the Softwood Lumber Board and the Binational Softwood Lumber Council, had put on. It was a competition that was basically modeled after a Canadian competition to create the first CLT buildings, first mass timber buildings that are high-rise in Canada. They've been doing this technology in Europe for the last 15 to 20 years. Canada just, you know, finished their competition, and so the U.S. government basically said, let's do that in the United States. So we said, why don't we go for this competition? If we win the competition, then we'll have, you know, kind of the backing financially and also politically, because part of the competition was that you needed to show that your jurisdictions were kind of along for the ride, but that they were interested also in being innovative and looking at this technology. Fast forward, we won the competition along with a team from New York. And so we were the West Coast winners, and it's a competition for $1.5 million that basically allows us to do the research and testing needed to prove out the technology. So like I tell a lot of people, this project is actually two projects. One is a pure research and development project, and then the other one is an actual real estate project that uses that data that's and innovation that's done on the first part to build a project. The project that we submitted is a 12-story project called Framework, and it's all wood. And Thomas will talk more about that in his presentation. And really, at the end of the day, one of the reasons they told us that we won the competition is because rather than just looking at this as a building, we really understood how a building could be a trigger, a demand trigger in the United States to create a whole new industry. So the idea that you had Oregon managed forest, which you can see on the top, feeding into lumber mills, creating value engineered product that had extra value, and then those going into tall wood buildings, which eventually would kind of be the next generation of healthy cities. Understanding this cycle, they said, was very critical to us winning the competition. And then thinking about, you know, the materials and the inherent properties in wood to sequester carbon in the buildings was a part of that equation. And so The building basically has 12 floors. The first floor is retail. The next five floors are office. The idea behind the office was that it's offices that are trying to attract B corporations, so corporations that have social and economic benefit to the communities that they're in. Albina Community Bank would be located on the ground floor with Beneficial State Bank on the second and third floor. And then there would be three floors of speculative office that would be marketed to be corporations and or corporations that are involved or businesses that are involved in the wood products industry. And then the upper floors would be affordable housing owned and managed by Home Forward. Jonathan will speak after me in regard to this. And so the idea behind the programming of the actual programming of the building was the idea that rather than saying this is an office building or this is a residential building, that the two of them together could work. The bank could offer individual development accounts to the residents that live there, and really trying to build economic wealth in the residents that live there so that they could move on from that affordable housing and basically allow that space to be taken by somebody else. And so it wasn't really seen as two different parts, but really synergistic uses in the building.
Thanks.
Thank you, Anule, and thank you, committee members, for your time and for this opportunity to talk about this project. My name is Jonathan. Last name is Trutt, T-R-U-T-T. I am the Director of Real Estate Development at Home Forward. So Home Forward is a public agency. We are Multnomah County's housing authority. We're 75 years old, and we're one large part of Multnomah County's affordable housing infrastructure. So our mission is to assure that county residents with low incomes are housed, and especially people with barriers to housing because of income, disability, or special need. So we are Oregon's largest affordable housing provider. We serve approximately 15,000 households throughout the county through our own real estate portfolio and our Section 8 programs. More than 80% of the people we house are very low-income households. 60% approximately are elderly and or disabled, and roughly half of the households we serve self-identify as people of color. So it's a little bit about us. Our interest in this project stems from any number of very exciting things about it. First and foremost, it's affordable housing in a choice location. So the Pearl's success, I'm sure everybody's seen it grow over the last really two decades, and it was catalyzed by significant public investment in the infrastructure of that neighborhood. And as an organization with our mission, we're delighted to have an opportunity to help low-income households reap the benefit of all that public investment, all of the transit, all of the services that are down there. It makes sense to have households with low incomes in the midst of that vibrant community. So Framework enables access to a high opportunity network, or excuse me, neighborhood. It's right in the middle of many jobs and services. And from a public perspective, that provides a strong return on the previous investment in roads and parks and transit. It's an opportunity for the service workers who make the Pearl a vibrant place to live in that community, to stay in that community, to take advantage of the mass transit there and stay off of the roads and also avoid the cost of having a car. And as we'll talk more about, but Anule already alluded to, it's also an opportunity for us as an organization to see through our commitment to our environmental values. Many of our buildings are built to LEED certification. We're always looking for opportunities to be responsible environmental stewards at the same time that we're housing the population that we were created to house. So we're excited about the public-private partnership that this project, the Framework, brings together to build this aspect of our affordable housing infrastructure. We found over our many decades that partnership is instrumental in meeting our mission. So here we have an opportunity to partner with a mission-focused bank that shares our goals of community improvement, and we have been a major client of Albina Community Bank for more than a decade. It's an opportunity to partner with a civic-minded developer and project. It's an opportunity to partner with rural Oregon and with the mills that would be producing this particular timber product that's so innovative. And it's an opportunity, at the same time, we're leveraging significant private investment to meet multiple public objectives simultaneously. So I've talked about the affordable housing and the Pearl. I would add that the green job economic development within the city that the commercial space creates opportunities for is something that's of great interest to us. We're very excited about the urban-rural link and the timber jobs in rural Oregon that this project could help create and maintain. We find that one-third of the homeless population in Multnomah County comes from elsewhere in the state. And that is, of course, a response to the fact that the job situation in parts of our state is it's not a very robust economy. At an executive session held last year, as we were describing this project to our board, one of our board members described this as exactly the type of project government should be investing in. And so we're excited to see all the momentum that's been created, and we're committed to seeing this through.
Excellent. Thank you. So we'll have the other two speakers go ahead, and then we'll provide we'll have opportunity for questions of the panel. But I just want to note, Jonathan, as you two switch places, that it's great to see you in your new role. And Jonathan has really devoted his whole professional life to affordable housing development up to now. He was in a director role prior to now at Northwest Housing Alternatives, which is one of the biggest nonprofit affordable housing developers and does really important work for people with significant barriers to living independently in other environments. So it's great, great get by HAP, by Home Forward, to have you be there.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Jonathan, and thank you, members of the committee, for allowing us to present framework and the other work we're doing. My name is Thomas Robinson, and I'm the principal and founder of Lever Architecture. We're a firm based in Portland. I would say, let me just see how forward here. Oh, the keyboard. Okay. Oregon is truly innovating in cross-laminated timber, and we believe that innovation is something that reflects our values as a state. And what I want to talk about today is really give you examples of two projects that are doing exactly that. One is Albina Yard, which is actually our office, and the image you see on the screen there is a 10-foot by 25-foot cross-laminated timber panel that was installed in our office in February. And the other is Framework, which obviously we've been talking about, which would be the first high-rise office building or mixed-use building in the United States and the tallest all-wood building in North America. And I'll explain exactly the details of what that is and really what makes a high-rise a high-rise. So this truck, which actually Valerie owns, left Riddle around 6 a.m. probably in February, middle of February. It arrived on our site at 9:30 a.m. and by noon they'd placed 4,000 square feet of floor. So if you understand construction, that's basically 3 hours. It's more than 1,000 feet an hour. So that's really what's innovative about this, is we're actually building buildings in rural Oregon and then we're actually assembling them in Portland. So that kind of that work and the design and the fabrication of this building was all done in Oregon. So this building is really the first building in the United States using domestically fabricated cross-laminated timber for a whole structure. So, you know, the steel you see here, the beams you see here, the panels you see here, they're all coming from Oregon fiber. They're being fabricated both in Riddle and also in Portland, some of the digital fabrication. And our job is really to put that all together to make a real project. And that work is what we're building on relative to Framework. So Framework is not our first CLT project. It's not an experiment. It's something we know how to do. And we learned a huge amount from doing this building. And these slides are a little bit short, so for it's a high rise, it's a little taller than what you're seeing here. But you probably have that in your brochure. It's also a beautiful place. This is our office. This is where we work every day. So we're designing the nation's first high-rise CLT in a domestically fabricated CLT building, and we're really excited about that. This is the stair that we go up every day, man, on a CLT. And I would invite you to come visit. If you're in North Portland, please come by, and if you want to see it in person, we're happy to have you there. So Framework, high-rise wood, what does that mean? Framework is completely different than anything that has been done before in the United States and in some cases the world. And I want to talk a little bit about what that means. It's basically what we're doing is we're going above that red line. You see here it says 85 feet, and that means we're in an area of the code that doesn't exist for wood buildings. So what we're having to do is do what's called a performance-based design. What that means is we have to lay out a path in collaboration with the state and the city to prove that the building that we're doing not only meets the code in terms of life safety, but in many cases exceeds it. And I think there's a whole set of requirements that kicks in once you go above 85 feet, because you have to be able to fight the fire from within the building as opposed with a big ladder from the outside. So lots of requirements. I'll get into the testing that we had to do that was required to do that. So innovation, the innovation that we had to sort of focus on to make that happen is really getting into really understanding wood as a product on the cellular level. So this is an electron microscope view of the wood fibers and understanding how to use those in a new way. Because in the past, what we did is we took these amazing old growth trees and we cut them down into, quote, smaller members to make tall wood buildings. Now what we're doing is actually using our understanding of the wood fibers and how they behave to create cross-laminated timber, which is basically taking the fibers and crossing them and laminating them together to create a very stable product. So basically our building that you saw there, the office, it's basically fabricated to an eighth-inch tolerance once you get above the concrete. So those of you who have been in construction, eighth inch is very tight. And it's sort of unheard of tolerances, but it went together perfectly, and we expect framework to do the same. One of the key things about this project is we're using our understanding of wood to create a building that can basically survive the big one in terms of earthquakes and be repairable. This is something that's not as sort of well known in the public, but what we're doing is creating what's called a post-tension cross-laminated timber rocking wall core. It's a lot of words, but basically what it is imagine my arm is a 140-foot tall thick wood wall, and it's post-tension down the center, and so it can rock, and then the tensioning of those cables pulls it back to center. This has been used in New Zealand for a while. We're taking this to a new level and testing it, and we think it's a great opportunity to combine some of the needs we have relative to resiliency and seismic with the great Douglas fir product that we have here. So some more of the details of how that works. We could spend another 20 minutes just talking about this, but I won't. One of the key things about the design is really that we want people to understand when they walk by that this is a wood tower. It's a different type of building. So it's important for us that this building be not only efficient and functional, but also something that people understand right away, that you can see the wood is actually holding up this tower, and that it's an icon for Oregon and for Portland. There's a public lobby in the space that would be used both by the bank and the residents. It's a double height space, and there's an exhibit devoted to timber that's just off of that, so that we see, and I think the USDA and other folks see this as a destination for people to come learn about the future of building in cities. This is the image of the office space. One of the key things here is because we're doing high rise, we had to figure out a way to where we wanted to expose the wood, but it also had to be two-hour rated connection. So that means it can burn for 2 hours without sprinklers and basically hold itself up. So the detail that we've developed for that are the first in world details. This is the affordable housing component. We actually are showing less wood. We're only seeing Dear Johnson's beautiful fir panels on the ceiling. And then to end, we'll talk about it, the testing that we've done. So as part of that performance-based design, we're basically creating a path, and as part of that path, we're doing full-scale testing of specific components of the building. So we're doing computer modeling of the whole design and then proving them out with full-scale testing. This is the 9-ply wall I was talking about, and these are put together. We're also doing fire testing. We did about 20 fire tests in San Antonio, Texas. They are complete and they're successful. We have all the reports. What we're doing with fire, people ask, well, how do you get it to be fire resistant? Wood is inherently fire resistant when it's big. You think about old growth trees. The forest used to burn, and that was how part of their ecosystem is, that the large trees would stay, the smaller trees would get burned and cleared out. People know Oregon history used to be able to drive wagons through the forest because that's how they worked. We're taking that characteristic of wood, the char, which slows down the fire, And we're basically taking small steel elements and embedding them, cutting them out with CNC machinery into the wood. And you can see there on the right a famous photo of the steel I-beams bent over of an intact wood beam. So wood doesn't fail catastrophically like steel at a certain temperature. So we're taking the best of both, but steel's very strong. So we've developed this detail. You can see there the steel elements embedded in the wood. So this connection can burn for 2 hours, and we tested it here in Texas with a two-hour burn with 25,000 pounds on it the entire time, and it was the first in the world to be successful. We're also doing what they call seismic testing with our partners at Portland State. This is that same detail where we have to actually rack it and simulate an earthquake. It performed with almost no damage to 3 times the drift that it would encounter in the design. We also did very first in the world testing of this type of panel at Oregon State University. This is basically that rocking wall on its side with a 500 kips actuator. It's 500,000 pounds actually on that right there. We did acoustic testing in Pennsylvania for the we needed to do this with panels for Dear Johnson. And I think all this testing is applicable to other projects. The idea is this framework is a complex project. It's the first in many ways, but that testing for the acoustics can work in housing, the seismic can work in other types of office buildings that are fully office, and I think that's something that's important, that we're trying to develop details that aren't patents, they're actually open source. So I'm just going to end with framework first. It's the first mass timber high-rise in the U.S., tallest mass timber building in the United States. It's the tallest post-tension rocking wall project in the world. It's the first high-rise in the building with exposed wood of any percentage, so above 85 feet. So we had to prove it out in fire. And it's the first project to carry out the type of fire tests that I kind of described for you. And then just the test results will be made public because that work is basically what is funded by the USDA. So just to end, I think we wanted the project to have a forum that represented the values of Oregon, which we see sort of as innovation, sustainability, and the connection between urban and real, rural.
Thank you. All right, so our last speaker for this big group of speakers is Ms. Johnson, and then after that, hopefully we'll have a chance to do some interaction.
Thank you very much, Chair Leininger and Vice Chairs Marsh and Brock Smith. I'm so pleased to have been asked to join this talented panel here this morning. They've really already hit it out of the park, I think, as to the benefits of mass timber building as well as their own project of frameworks. But I'll add a few perspectives from our a vantage point there in Riddle, Oregon. I am a co-owner, along with my sister Jody Westbrooks, of both D.R. Johnson Lumber Company and D.R. Johnson Wood Innovations. Our parents founded the lumber company in 1951 in small town Riddle, southern Douglas County, and constructed our glue lamp beam plant in 1967, formerly known as Riddle Laminators and now known as D.R. Johnson Wood Innovations. When our expansion to manufacture mass timber panels in the glue lamp plant was completed in 2015, we became the first certified manufacturer of structural cross-laminated timbers, or CLTs, in the United States, and only the third certified company in North America. Point out that if you were the photographer standing where that picture is taken, the glue lamp beam plant that's been operating for 50 years is directly behind your back, and everything you see in that picture was our expansion to make CLTs. I'm pleased to participate to testify as to the benefits of the Frameworks project, which has been so very, very well documented by Thomas, and how that project itself becomes a catalyst to both the economic growth of our company and our community, as well as the developing urban-rural connection we witness and sense growing stronger every day. We're not going to dwell on our plant, but the machine you see directly ahead on the right-hand side, the panels are laid up on these rollers. They go into that machine that says Honegger on the front. It's a press. The glues are laid on the alternate perpendicular layers and go into that press. The press is held down to about 120 psi for 2 or 2.5 hours, depending on the table. And on the left-hand side, that bright blue and yellow machine is from Germany. It's a Honegger machine. It's computer numeric cutting machine. It's a robotic cutting machine, actually, that our CAD modeling expert in our office puts on a program and sends down to that machine electronically, and it cuts within a precision of about 1/16 to 1/32 of an inch. Examples of the CNC machine to ship precisely fabricated beams and panels is one part of what Thomas was mentioning, that this is building a building in our plant in rural Oregon, quite an economically depressed area of the state, and shipping it to Portland to actually be constructed there. I just offer this to you, if you can see the routing there. In that bottom right panel, that's an example of some of the things this machine can do. But it can, you know, I tell people it can make your coffee in the morning if you tell it how. It really can do almost anything for our panels.
Just in that box.
The research that this Frameworks project and the team is helping to create a process for these challenges that we expect to use many years in the future. This additional product line has added about 11 to 12 positions in our company, and we expect that shortly after we are running at full capacity, which we hope to be by the middle of the summer, and we'll shortly thereafter add a second shift, we will add another 10 or so employees. That's 20 to 22 positions in Little Oregon would be something like 100 times that in urban areas. And the Frameworks project is really, truly a key reason for why this growth is happening. Go ahead. Thomas has already talked extensively about testing. The one in the upper right is just a strength panel test, but the one on the upper left is one of the fire tests he mentioned. Our company did pass a 2-hour naked panel test, which means didn't have any gypsum, didn't have any covering on it at all, and it did not reach failure at 2 hours. It never did reach failure, but they decided to shut it down because typically panels have trouble making an hour and a half of success. So we believe that's partly because of the Douglas fir and also because of some of the new manufacturing techniques we're using. And in the bottom left, which doesn't have anything to do with frameworks yet, but it could, because the Department of Defense now requires all projects on their military bases to be blast resistant, and that blast testing down in the lower right was from 3 different manufacturers, and all 3 of the mass timber constructions you see there did pass that test. Go ahead. This is just a graphic that I threw in because I keep glancing back at it every now and then. It caught my eye in late 2015. All of those dots were, this is a project that was pulled together by a reporter at the Oregonian at the time. And they all showed construction projects in the metropolitan area in progress, which just kind of took my breath away sitting there in Riddle, Oregon, not having a new building built there in probably 30 years or more. And to see that kind of vitality and that kind of hunger and a market for construction products made us feel even that much more positive that going into constructing cross-laminated timbers was the right thing to do. It also has created, knowing that our products are going into the urban area, frankly, has really had an effect on our own employees. They're taking great pride in knowing that they're manufacturing products that will be used for construction in urban areas. It makes them feel tied to that somewhat. And also, I can tell you that the interest in construction in urban areas often states specifically they are only interested in products being manufactured if in Oregon, or at least in the Pacific Northwest. The pride's not only because of the beauty of our product, but knowing that we are partnering with design build teams like the Framework Project to provide a more environmentally friendly, lower carbon emitting, renewable and sustainable product for the increasing demand in urban areas. The urban-rural divide has existed too long in Oregon. Our people are now feeling proud of their work once again and beginning to believe that perhaps urban areas will respect what we do as well. And further, we're hoping that our young people will grow up once again believing there's a future for them doing this type of work. The next slide is, has already been mentioned, it's the schematic or the image for the new building that's going up on the Oregon State campus. It's a PV Hall rebuild. And these two projects have a synergistic relationship with Frameworks, really cutting the leading the way in many, many ways. But much of what's being done in testing and engineering is also being implemented in that building, and it will be, in fact, a very beautiful building for many years as well, Frameworks. College, speaking just to the future for a moment, college students from all over schools, these happen to be college students from the University of Nebraska, are eager to learn and participate in this new mass timber construction revival. We estimate that we have hosted several hundred visitors, excuse me, through our plant within the last 2.5 years, and at least 150 of those visitors have been college students and college faculty. This mass timber movement is for real. It is happening. It is growing every month. We are receiving new inquiries for new projects at the rate of at least one or two per week. The next generation feels it and is eager to be part of it. This not only continues to strengthen the cross education and respect between the urban, suburban, and rural areas of our state, it strengthens a new generation of respect for one another. Chair Leininger, Vice Chair Marsh, and Brock Smith, and members of the committee, we at D.R. Johnson thank you for your interest in this nationally significant 12-story project called Framework. We believe our efforts and your support of this project, that is literally a laboratory for the revival of building with mass timber, is an investment for which Oregonians will be grateful for many, many generations to come. Thank you for your support and your time.
Thank you so much. All right, I see a question from Representative Helm, and then one from Rep. Post, please, and then Rep. Marsh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my first comment is more of a request to the chair that you arrange a field trip for us as soon as possible.
Yeah. Excellent.
These are things that I would love to see in person. Two questions. One, they're both related to markets. One is, how replicable or scalable is cross-laminated timber as a business for other parts of the state? It's wonderful that you've built your business in Riddle. Can we build others? Will the market sustain other similar businesses in LeGrand and Pendleton? And then, Thomas, also, if you could talk about your competition in the market. Framework Project's exciting, but there's a couple others going on too, if I understand correctly, which is exciting in that we've got a bunch of cross-laminated timber buildings going on in Portland.
I think it's really important to understand sort of the chicken or the egg kind of deal, is that what Framework and our project does is it unlocks the high-rise, bigger building potential. All the other projects are sort of waiting for us to actually get built, because the testing that we're having to do these bigger projects is not needed if you're at 85 feet. So that's the big difference on that. So it is really about, if you can unlock it, then there's a lot of people out there that want to build these buildings, but they're not able to because they don't have the funding from the USDA to do all this testing. So right now, every time you want to go above 85 feet, you have to go through the process that we've gone through. I think I know Just speaking about the market as a whole, in Europe there are 14 manufacturers across laminated timber. There are hundreds of buildings that are being built there out of it. It's a very robust market because they have the testing in place. And I think that, you know, one of the key things for us is to do this project to sort of prove it out, and then things will follow. We also know, we do work all around the country. We know there are major projects in California that are huge projects that want to move forward, but they need sort of the kind of goods. Like here, you need to show the code authority that this can be built. I don't know if Valerie has anything.
There are buildings that are moving forward as well. I can't, most of them require us to sign non-disclosure agreements, so I can't give you too much on it, but I can assure you that we have a number of at least mid-size and a couple of very big projects that are down the pipeline a ways and are coming closer and closer to the contract stage. So when I say the market's for real, I'm telling you it is for real, and there will be a tipping point at which we won't be able to supply in the timeline they need, and it will create a demand. And there are other, trust me, this is a very competitive industry. There are plenty of other companies out there. Just they've got their ear to the ground. They're just waiting to that one signal that, yep, we're safe. We can go ahead and invest the money it will take to build another plant. And we expect clearly another 4 to 6 in the Northwest anytime within the next 3 to 10 years.
And just from the real estate development perspective, obviously we want you to succeed as much as possible, but you need a competitive set, right? If a real estate developer is going to get into this and they're going to say, well, who are my 4, 5, you know, that I can bid and have this competitive set, and that currently doesn't obviously exist in the market. And so I think there are a lot of premiums that get that will be associated with our project that Project 2, 3, 4 won't have at all because of kind of the headway that we've made with ours.
Thank you. So we've got a number of other questions for you. Representative Post, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, this project has excited me for a long time since I first chatted about it several years ago with the Freres boys.
We're working with them on another project.
Exactly, yeah. So I was glad to hear that. And also, I think some folks at Seneca are looking at this sort of work, if not already. There are a couple of things that come to me that I think are fascinating is when you talk about expansion. So, Valerie, down in Riddle, my wife's family has probably provided you a lot of timber over the years, out in Camas Valley.
Tell them to keep it coming.
Yeah, they would like to. There's problems with that, which is why I'm concerned. I want this to grow and expand and blow up and be fantastic. It's almost back to the future. Imagine those people in the 19th and 20th centuries actually knew what they were talking about, building things out of wood. But the problem is, where are you going to get your supply if this thing blows up? And we build these buildings all over Portland, all over everywhere. Where's the supply going to come from? Because your picture of the forest when the wagons rolled through is exactly what the forest is supposed to be, not what it looks like today. So that's my fear, is that, because this is a great project. This is an incredible project. I mean, wow, we're doing double duty. We're building incredible buildings, and we're taking the carbon out, which we've talked about for years with furniture and all kinds of wood products. So what, Valerie, I'm concerned, where's the future of the harvest?
Well, we share your concern, and I don't usually try to mix this into a positive presentation, but the bottom line is unavoidable. Without the supply of logs, the dimension mills that cut the lumber we use for these cross-laminated panels and our glue lam beams will either become much more expensive to sell to us, and going to the bottom line issue, make us not competitive, not us or anyone else trying to make mass timber, or we will simply have just such a limited amount that we won't be able to produce, supply the demand of a growing market. But clearly the issue about healthy forest management, particularly on public lands, must still be decided. It is not yet, and we would appreciate anyone's involvement and participation in that there is. But in the meantime, we're hoping that we can show really valid and strong reasons to be pursuing that.
Good, thanks.
Can I add one thing? I think it's a lot of what you're talking about is also changing perceptions and connecting people, because I think there's a perception out there in some people, maybe you'd say the environmental side is like, oh, you shouldn't actually leave, you should leave the forests as they are. They shouldn't be managed. They should just be left as they are. And what I think people are learning is that forests need to be managed. They need to be harvested. And the idea that cross-laminated timber, that you can actually use smaller trees and elements to actually manufacture that, I think one of the first steps is you get a building out there and you can say, hey, this is sustainable. This is actually about healthy forests. That changes perceptions, and I think that opens up opportunity to actually harvest more federal land and things of that nature.
Did you want to do a follow-up or
no?
A little set? Okay. I think that this is – we're going to go to Representative Marsh and then Representative Brocksmith. I'd love to jump in and note that I think that this is a really exciting project. I think the idea of creating economic opportunity in rural Oregon while we innovate and create economic opportunity in urban Oregon is really important. I think, you know, it's fair to acknowledge, though, that there reasonable people have differences of opinion on whether the Oregon Forest Practices Act, as it currently is in the perfect spot. And we don't even have to resolve that question in this group to all celebrate that this project seems like a really wonderful opportunity. So we probably do ourselves a service by not having to have loving this project be synonymous with loving the Oregon Forest Practices Act as is, because otherwise we might risk some allies for this great project that we don't need to risk. And we can have that good conversation, you know, in other forums with other people. But this looks like a great project. Representative Marsh.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. My question is really much related to the prior comments. Whether or not this is a green project really still ultimately depends on where the wood comes from and what tactics are used to harvest it. And if you are, so I'm wondering from the project proponents to what degree you intend to involve yourselves in those specific issues, because to the extent that the project is advertised as a green project, that's an inevitable part of the conversation.
Yeah. And I think, you know, by the backers of this project come from probably first and foremost an environmental viewpoint. So I think that is a big question and something that we're exploring and have been exploring. I think, you know, it's going toward that chicken and egg scenario is as you create an industry and it becomes very, you know, economically viable for a community that it's in, then there's more opportunity to engage in these topics. We wanted to be careful not to kind of stifle this process by trying to do every single thing on this particular project, understanding that as projects come in the future, there's a greater leverage and ability to do that. I think as a developer, as an owner, you have some discretion with regard to what you require in your project. So, you know, in a regular project, you say, I want this to be LEED, I want it to be all LFFC, I want it to be all SFI. You have that leverage to do that. Obviously, there are premiums associated with some of those, and so like any development project, we have to kind of struggle with that. We are interfacing with a lot of research teams, and I think that's what's interesting about you saying that this is a laboratory. We're talking to a graduate team in OSU about creating a tool that kind of evaluates all the different certification measures of the wood that basically allows developers like myself to make informed choices about, okay, if we go with this, this is what I'm sacrificing or not. Mm-hmm. This is important to me. This is not. And so we've been working collaboratively to do that with them. We've been also talking to a Forest Service team that's also partnered with the U.S. Endowment, that's also partnered with the a whole bunch of other people to do a carbon analysis study specifically of our building in relation to like buildings, some a mixture of CLT and other components in some conventional buildings. So one of the amazing parts about this project, when it's built, it will actually provide the data to have a real conversation about how much is this really doing with regard to carbon sequestration. That research project that they're doing is actually a life cycle analysis to show from the beginning all the way to kind of the end of the project how that impacts the carbon. And I think a lot of these projects, we're only talking about either the wood itself in the forest, and then we're talking about the building itself, and we're not really connecting it as a life cycle of a project. And that research is going to be done on this building, and it's going to come out, and it's going to say, this is what it is. Is that enough? Is that going to really change practices or not? So I think we're in the middle of that right now. And this project is going to be instrumental in understanding the nuances of those choices.
That's a great point. Representative Brockman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have a few questions, and hopefully you can answer them, maybe. The Frameworks building, how much carbon is going to be sequestered in that building?
It goes back to the same question that we were just talking about. It depends on the sourcing of the wood. So there's about 1 million board feet in the building. So a lot of it is based on how that wood is, how those forests are managed. Luckily in Oregon, I know with the Oregon Forest Act, you know, there are certain basic standards about how forests are managed. So we have that base. And then the question is how do you go up from there? So I would sort of not to... I don't want to give you a specific answer because I don't have it yet.
But we have a preliminary number.
We have a preliminary number.
That's right. It's like 1,804 tons of carbon would be sequestered based on, I think...
the million board feet.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we have AIRUP, which is a leading international engineer working on the project, who came up with that preliminary analysis. And actually, when we did an RFP with all the different manufacturers, they did an analysis that included the whole entire, you know, if it was coming from Europe, you know, the shipping from Europe, or if it was being trucked from Canada, how would that be? If it was coming from D.R. Johnson, yeah. all of that analysis went into us thinking about where the wood was sourced. And so they did my point was they did a preliminary one. When the buildings actually, when we, you know, bid it all out and got it, everybody who's participating in it, they'll do another analysis, and that would be a part of the life cycle analysis.
Yeah, we're doing a U.S. forest life cycle analysis with North Carolina State is leading that effort. And basically what it is we're, I think it's important to think of not just the wood, but to think of this building in comparison to building out of concrete or building a building out of steel. So if you think about embodied energy and carbon, so embodied energy is the amount of energy it takes to make the building. So concrete is 9 times more than, say, embodied energy that it takes to actually create the building in terms of carbon, as opposed to, say, wood. So there's those kinds of studies that we're doing. We're trying to do an apples-to-apples comparison of the issues for each of those buildings relative to this life cycle analysis. So that's coming out of this, but we can't actually... You can't actually do that and really be certain about it until you have every product and every piece in place.
Representative Brocksmith, I think you had a follow-up question.
Thank you. Well, and some comments. So I had the opportunity to tour the D.R. Johnson Mill last summer with the group with the Southern Oregon China Connection. It's a fantastic facility. And my understanding is, because of capacity, roughly 50% of the CLT that's going to build this building is going to come from D.R. Johnson. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes. Yep.
And we made that goal when we started the competition. We said 50% from Oregon. They hadn't even started the the CLT at that point. So we went out there with a high goal and said, that's what we want, and we're going to figure out how to make it. And now we're going to be able to realize that goal.
Yeah, you know, so I'm kind of upset and disappointed that there isn't more people in the audience here, because cross-laminated timber and what we're doing here, and what you're doing, excuse me, here is I believe the future of the wood products industry in Oregon. And when we have conversations about carbon sequestration and what we can do with forest management and shifting that conversation and talking about the fact that you're not only sequestering carbon, but you're reducing carbon emissions because of the, my aggregate guys will get upset with me, because you're not using concrete to build, and my steel workers will get upset with me because we're not using steel to build, but we're using a wood fiber. And we go even deeper with the wood fiber and being able to manage our timber resources more effectively so that we aren't burning the very carbon up that the advocates are wanting to sequester. Mm-hmm. And so when we have a conversation in my other committee, everything's relative in the four committees that I'm on in regards to when we have conversations about cap and trade and reducing emissions. I believe that we can be innovators in Oregon and innovators in the cross-laminated timber industry. So when we want to build along the coast, we utilize the seismically resilient CLTs, right? When we want to build throughout Oregon, because we know those events, that Cascadia event is going to be through the I-5 corridor, we utilize cross-laminated timber. And when we want to build across the country, we can do the same. And so I'm excited to hear that three or four, even though I appreciate D.R. Johnson being the leader, but three or four or five or ten of our industry sector mills are ready to tool up. Hopefully they're next to transportation corridors. Hopefully we have a push, and I hope that this legislative body can embrace what we can do here with CLT and how we can lead the nation and build the nation in doing so.
And I forgot one thing that I'd like
please
to mention.
Go ahead.
Regarding
and then we're going to go to Rep. Rushkey.
Okay. One of the important distinctions, I think, for the state of Oregon is that we've actually been working with the Oregon Building Codes Division throughout this whole entire project. So most projects, you get your drawings and then you give it. They've actually been there since conceptual design. They went and saw the fire test firsthand, saw the seismic test firsthand. And the idea behind that is they could write a code right now for CLT if they wanted to. It'd be super conservative. In the fire life safety regard, when they came time to change the code, it would be really hard to change it because people would think they're going down in life safety. Going through this project actually allows them to see what is physically viable with regard to code, but also helps them to understand economically viable also. And so after this project is obviously permitted and built, there'll be that much more knowledge with that along with the other CLT projects to actually write a code that's responsive to all of these. And that code is the one that the International Code Divisions are looking at, this project in particular, looking at our testing to write a national code based on that. I want to stress how important this project is, not just in the if it gets built, we have the first, but actually if it gets built, when it gets built, it will kind of set the standard for future code.
Excellent. Representative Rushkey, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for your presentation. Exciting projects going on. We've heard about environment. We've heard about supply. We've heard about the newness and the excitement in the code. As a capitalist, to see this industry grow and maintain, I'm curious as to the cost compared to traditional materials to build an identical building. And I know this building is going to be different because it's got all the barriers that you've had to go through as far as the testing and the code change and so forth. If all that had been done and we were just going to compare apples to apples or wood to steel, what's the difference in cost? And it may be higher and it may be okay because the market is willing to pay for this because it's new or because it's better in some way. So I'm just trying to understand that on the cost side.
Yeah, and we haven't, I would like you to talk on this. We haven't come out with the cost for this particular building. I personally don't think somebody's going to literally replicate our building.
Yeah.
I think our building is there really as a vehicle for testing completely different components. Like the things we had to do for the residential are completely not applicable for the office. So the fact that we combined all these things makes it a high premium.
Yeah.
It also makes it the components of it more replicable for other people. So if I were to do a number two CLT project, it would not be this look like this. It would probably be maybe an all office one or an all residential one. We've heard from other developers in Europe that when they started, it was more expensive, and now it's cost neutral. We've also pushing the limit with regard to the showing the wood in the project, which has put a lot of premium on this particular one. So I would just want to preface framework as being kind of the laboratory for the future projects, but not necessarily that people will replicate ours with regard to cost.
That the framework on framework. Yeah.
I mean, I just want to point out how Vineyard is a commercial project. Yeah. It's there's you know so the small project that you saw, it's viable today in North Portland where creative office is a premium, and people were willing to pay more for a beautiful space. So it's purely that. Okay. I think what framework is doing is unlocking in a market. So if you think of steel, at one time, steel, people thought people were crazy doing steel. And there was a time when people thought people were crazy doing post-tension concrete floors. And now that's just standard.
Right.
And all the testing and the research has been done. None of that has been done for this type of building. And that's really what we're trying to do. And we're trying to really just to address, leverage the forest products that we have. Because there's a lot of logs that are actually just shipped in their raw form overseas.
Right.
So if you can actually leverage what's already sort of being harvested, actually even without people have talked about leveraging that and giving adding value to that in the communities that people live in, we think that's a really good thing.
I think that's a great point, and I like that you're emphasizing the extent to which this is a demonstration project that's going to prove the merit of this type of construction and the local sourcing and the earthquake survivability and carbon sequestration for other projects going forward. And I want you to be aware that in recognition of the fact that this is an exciting demonstration project that we expect will catalyze further development and economic opportunity in rural communities and in urban parts of the state. Representative Brock Smith and I have submitted a request together for an amendment to a committee bill before this committee, House Bill 2752, that would encourage the Ways and Means Committee to put in a $2 million appropriation to help support the project cost. And it's not quite ready today for our committee to talk about, but hopefully in the near future we'll have a chance to talk about the idea that as one expression of our work as an Economic Development and Trade Committee, we might want to encourage our spending brethren to consider an investment in this project to help show what a good idea it is and what a good idea it can be for economic opportunity in our state. So stay tuned. Thanks so much for being here today to talk about all the values that this is demonstrating and exploring. Any additional questions for this good panel? All right, with that, we'll thank you. We'll close the information hearing we won't reopen, and we have Amanda Walker from Global Strategies at Business Oregon to come forward. Ms. Walker, thank you. I'm sorry about that. So we remain open, and we enthusiastically welcome Amanda Walker forward.
Oh, boy.
As our finale. The grand finale of a lovely presentation. Thank you, all presenters who came here today.
Well, welcome. Good morning, Representative Chair Leininger and committee members. My name is Amanda Welker. I'm Global Strategies Officer at Business Oregon. And wanted to present to you today some work that the state is doing around mass timber, CLT included in that, as we look at economic development and global trade here in Oregon. I want to start out what we've been doing in the past really 4 or 5 months. This effort has really grown. We've worked closely over the years on softwood exports out of Oregon, right to different markets. We're the second largest timber state in the country. So looking at that next opportunity, looking 3, 5, 7 years down the road, where do we go next? What is the strategy moving forward? Took an opportunity to go to a trade show in Europe, a UK construction show, where we had Oregon lumber companies exhibiting there. And during this time in Europe, we got to visit with some of the leading manufacturers of CLT, Austria, Germany, and kind of learn from them. We also got to talk with designers, engineers, architects, construction firms in the UK to learn best practices and learn what's happening in the market over there. They've been doing this for almost 15 years, so there's a lot of best practices that we can adopt here, learn from. They are willing to work with us here in Oregon. It was interesting when we were in Austria that we're in this tiny little town, And this person knows about Malheur County. This person knows about John Day, Oregon. That's not something that you hear very often. So Oregon is making its way and really is well positioned to be a leader as the U.S. market emerges. The UK has 500 buildings. They've been working on this for 13 years. So kind of wanted to learn from them. Where did they start? How did they get there? Obviously, they had all the barriers that we're experiencing now. They started with schools. They started with social housing projects. That's how they got there. You know, the UK and City of London were looking at some challenges in affordable housing. You know, we think we have a problem here in Oregon, London. You can imagine bus drivers, police officers, firefighters cannot afford to live in the cities that they serve. So they needed to come up with solutions for people to live. So mass timber has become a solution for them. They can build them in a green way that saves money in the long run over over the life cycle. We also met with a large manufacturer in northern UK, rural area. So this was a London pension fund, billions and billions of dollars, looking for that next investment opportunity. They went out, did their own research, came back, and decided they wanted to go into mass timber to grow their fund. So they put a plant up in Leeds, UK, and employed 400 people opening up this factory in this rural part of the UK to develop affordable social housing for their housing crisis. In schools, they've been able to build high schools and primary schools in a summer. School lets out in June. The school is ready to go in September when they're ready to go back for the fall semester. So really, you know, some interesting lessons that we can learn. So we came back to Oregon after this trip and just started having meetings and, you know, saw that this was an opportunity where the state needed to step forward and be a convener, get together. You know, we've been hearing a lot of talk at our local and city levels about mass timber and what the opportunity is in our rural communities, excited about the opportunity this provides. So we put together a mass timber summit. I hope that you've all received an invitation to attend. It's 2 weeks from today on March 27th. Governor Brown will open up with some remarks, and we have brought in speakers from around the globe and around here in Oregon to talk about mass timber, learn best practices, educational summit, get everyone together on the same page. We'll have global partners here from UK, from Austria, from Australia, from Germany, Chile, Mexico, Canada, and Japan. So real opportunity to learn from these people. You know, in Japan, they have just adopted an overall building code for the country. They have six CLT manufacturers in Japan now and are building. Some of the concerns we talked about in the UK and Europe is they didn't have the seismic requirements that we need here in the Pacific Northwest. Obviously, Japan, Australia, Chile, those places have similar concerns. But we can't ignore that we have issues here in Oregon. We can learn these best practices from overseas. And certainly their goal, you know, they see a budding market here. They see an opportunity here to share their knowledge and see the U.S. market. Oregon is really well positioned with the first CLT manufacturer in the United States, with our forest industry. I think that we're very well positioned to, you know, lead this industry as it evolves here in the United States. So we've got international partners to do that, but we still have to look locally. You know, developing this industry in North America and the United States is different than Europe. It's different than Australia. We have to figure out what the consumer wants, what they demand. We have to figure out the building codes. We have to figure out the issues. We have to get people working together, talking together. And so the state is putting together this summit on March 27th to do that and explore those ideas, get everyone together on the same page. I think, you know, they've done a really good job explaining all the benefits to mass timber. Just a few things that I wanted to point out. Washington and California are on our heels developing this industry. The Washington legislature has given $5 million to support school construction in Washington with CLT and mass timber products. I think that we do see an opportunity. I think we had over $3 billion in school bonds passed in Oregon this last election. So perhaps there are some opportunities there as we look forward. And then, you know, there's concerns about the steel and concrete industry. The framework project is excellent. You know, it will set the bar and will set coding moving forward and something that's needed. But another best practice we learned overseas is many of their projects started as hybrids. So, you know, introducing these materials and working with steel and concrete and finding ways to incorporate CLT where they can with different engineers and architects. And there's also, you don't have to build the entire building out of CLT. You can use glue lams and plywoods and different advanced wood technology. And finally, we want to talk about the workforce and education opportunities that are available here in Oregon. Just back from another trip in Germany, talk with a software company. They have a dual education program there, as you may be aware, but where you can take a vocational track or the academic track on their education system. So they've got software companies working on CLT, developing software for CLT, and working within their school system. So I think those are opportunities in our rural areas where we can work on workforce development and create good jobs and technology and innovation moving together with really a legacy industry here in Oregon. And these are good paying jobs too. These are jobs in software. These are jobs in engineering. These are jobs that are good for rural Oregon. Might want to just follow up. Last week there was a press release from Congress introducing the Wood Innovation Act. So this is a bipartisan bill that's moving forward at the national level. So I think any support that Oregon can show at the national level that we can lead mass timber is welcomed.
Thank you so much, Ms. Welker. Any questions for our speaker? Yes, please, Madam
Marsh. Thank you, Madam Chair. One quick question. It sounds like I haven't seen the invitation for the event in a couple of weeks, but it sounds like you are definitely bringing all the partners together to talk about this. My question reflects back on my earlier one is it's important to have, as a partner to further this industry, a discussion of the actual logs and how the practices that are used in forestry to bring them to production. Mm-hmm. Is that going to be part of the conversation in 2 weeks?
Yes, it will be part of the conversation. In Europe, they do have models. They have some modeling on carbon sequestration and how that works out, life cycle analysis. Mm-hmm. They won't be identical to ours. The EU has largely adopted carbon as a measure of green. And environmentally friendly products, not so much here in the United States, but those models are there, and I think we can learn from them. We'll also be bringing in someone from the U.S. Forest Service from D.C. to talk about the supply issue and what's happening on a federal policy level there.
Great. Thank you. Any follow-up questions? All right. Thanks a lot. We really appreciate your presentation. Look forward to that event in 2 weeks. And Adam, if you could please help make sure that each of our offices gets a copy of that, that would be great. So it's at the top of the inbox. All right. So thank you for being here. And with that, I'll close the information session on cross-laminated timber, and we'll adjourn the meeting. Laminated timber, and we'll adjourn the meeting. And cross-laminated